Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Psychic Teachers Book Club. I'm your host, Samantha Fay.
And I'm Deb Bowen.
And we're so happy to have you here with us on this Monday morning. I hope it's nice where you are. Here it is rainy and cold, and it's the perfect day to sit inside, drink a cup of tea, and talk about books.
It is. Except I'm going to a Tai Chi class, but otherwise it is a great day to do that.
Yes, I love these days for, you know, just curling up with a good book. We are continuing our discussion of Dan Millman's Way of the Peaceful Warrior. We hope that you've been reading along with us and enjoying the book as much as we have always enjoyed it. We wanted to start by talking about, Deb and I received a couple of emails from people asking, well, how do I find my own Socrates? You know, how do I go about finding who my teacher, my mentor is? And I think that's such a good question. I know, Deb, that you and I touched upon it last week, and we said that mentors can pop up in many ways, not necessarily through the guise of a traditional teacher. But yeah. Sometimes our mentors come up in the form of a podcast or of a really intriguing book that changes your life in some way. Sometimes our own friends are mentors. You know, sometimes you'll just be talking with your friend and they'll say something so simple and profound that it wakens you up.
Sometimes we learn life lessons from people we don't like.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Very often they're our greatest teachers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I came across... On his website, peacefulwarrior.com, some questions and answers. And one of the things that he wrote about was an answer to people asking him, how do I find my own Socrates? So if you don't mind, I'm just going to briefly read what he said.
Great.
He said, practicing in isolation may breed illusions. We come to know ourselves best in relationship to others. While we can learn much from books, a personal teacher can tailor guidance to our individual temperament and needs. So Buddhism and other traditions recommend the trinity of a teacher, a teaching, and a community of practitioners as the ideal learning environment. But it's a minefield out there. Even genuine teachers are sometimes corrupted by the adulation of their devotees. So be wary and wise. Keep your eyes open as wide as your heart. Teachers need to earn their students' trust over time. Avoid any who demand complete devotion from the beginning. Pay attention less to what the teacher says than to what they do. That's good advice.
Mm-hmm.
And notice, do their students live a life to which you aspire? Are they kind, compassionate, balanced, healthy, honest, open, and respectful? Do they show a sense of humor? If not, look elsewhere. Our approach to teachers often corresponds to three stages of life: childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. Children seek a parent to guide and protect them. Adolescents reject authority and have a skeptical view of most teachers. Adults apply intelligent discernment and learn what they can when they can. And sometimes their teacher appears in the form of fools or sages, friends or adversaries, animals, infants, or elders. Master teachers are found not only on lonely mountaintops or in ashrams in the East. Our teachers take the form of friends and adversaries of clouds, animals, wind, and water. Moment to moment, our teachers reveal all we need to know. The question is, are you paying attention? When the student is ready, the teacher appears everywhere.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't that lovely?
It is.
And it's very true. And we talked about that a little bit last week, too, which was... you know, being aware. And then he shares a really neat story to illustrate this. Do you mind if I keep reading one more paragraph?
No, go ahead.
Okay. He says, Zembu, a young samurai, had an affair with the wife of his superior. When discovered, he slew the nobleman in self-defense, then fled to a distant province. Okay, let me see if I'm getting this right. So he has sex with his boss's wife and then kills the boss in defense?
That's what it sounds like.
Good Lord. Unable to find employment, he became a thief, of course. Until one morning, in a flash of understanding, Zembu saw what he had made of his life. To atone for the harm he had done, he resolved to accomplish some good deed as a sincere act of repentance. Soon after, while walking upon a dangerous road over a cliff that had caused the death of many persons, he decided to cut a tunnel through the mountain. Begging food to sustain himself during the day, Zembu dug each night, 30 years later, when the tunnel was 2,000 feet long, and within a few months of completion, Zembu was confronted by Katsuo, a young samurai who had come to kill him to avenge the death of his father, the nobleman whom Zembu had slain years before. Hello, karma.
Uh-huh.
Facing Katsuo's sword, Zembu said, "I will gladly give you my life if you will only allow me to complete my work." So Katsuo waited impatiently as several months passed, and Zembu kept digging. Seeing that Zembu was nearing the end and tired of doing nothing, Katsuo began to help Zembu dig. As they worked side by side, he came to admire Zembu's strong will and character. Finally, the tunnel was finished, and travelers could now pass safely. Zembu turned to the young swordsman. "My work is done. You may now cut off my head," he said. Tears flowed from Katsuo's eyes as he asked, "How can I cut off my own teacher's head?"
Oh, wow.
That's beautiful. It's a nice story of forgiveness, too, and healing, isn't it?
It certainly is. That's lovely. Absolutely. So, Samantha, you and I have teachers in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We have Socrates in our lives,
yes,
in many guises. In fact, the people who listen to our podcast, the people for whom we do readings,
mm-hmm,
the people with whom we do coachings.
Yes.
Those are also our teachers.
Yes. I met you because I wanted you to be my teacher.
That's right.
You were my tarot teacher.
I was. And look how much you have taught me since then.
It's quite equal. I'll say that.
Absolutely. You know, so we would invite you to think about who the Socrates, it's hard to say as a plural,
it is,
are in your life. And I bet you have more than you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And for whom are you, Socrates?
Mm, that's a good thing to ponder as well.
Mm-hmm. Who do you teach?
Yeah.
You know, Samantha and I were both college teachers for many years. We had thousands of students, literally. And of those thousands of students that I taught, I would venture to say that 99% of them were also my teachers.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Samantha, there's a quote in the book that I just love. Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, I have to tell people this, and I know that folks don't always like this idea, but I desecrate a book. I am terrible. I'm terrible. It's hard for me. When I borrow books from you, I have to consciously remember that it's not my book.
Oh, you can write in books you borrow from me.
Oh, I can?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, because I underline stuff. I dog-ear pages. I'm terrible. But it sure does help me find stuff later when I'm looking for it, you know?
I have to tell a quick story. Because I think it's so important when you're reading for college to desecrate a book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was in college, you would sell your textbooks at the end of the year.
Right.
And they would have new, very good used, and used.
Oh, dear.
And so, like, we would never write in our books because we wanted to get the very good used price.
Uh-huh.
Now they don't do that anymore. The minute, it's like buying a car. The minute you take it out of the store, it's used.
Absolutely.
So I would tell my students, you paid $65 for this book. You're going to get $12 for it in 16 weeks. Whether you never crack the binding or whether you pick your nose and leave your boogers in the pages every single day, it's $12.
Dear.
So write in the book, desecrate it.
So,
sorry, I digress.
Okay, thank you. You know, there's a real balance in this book of attention to mind, body, and spirit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I hadn't looked at that book, looked at this book this way until I reread it in preparation for these two shows. Because Dan, of course, is an amazing athlete. He's a gymnast. So there is such a focus and a control over the function of his body. And he has known that his mind and how he controls his thoughts have played into his ability to be that gymnast. But it wasn't until Socrates that he brought in the third aspect, the spirit part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he says, "My own body became a radiant prism, throwing splinters of multicolored light everywhere. And it came to me that the highest purpose of the human body is to become a clear channel for this light, so that its brightness can dissolve all obstructions, all knots, all resistance."
becoming a clear channel for the light.
Absolutely.
That's hard to do.
It sure is, and let me just read the next couple of sentences because that'll close it out. I felt the light diffracted across the systems of my own body. Then I knew that awareness is how the human being experiences the light of consciousness.
Awareness, there's that word again.
That's exactly right. There's that word again. That we have, that we are, that the light comes through us, we become the light, and to be aware of it then helps us to disseminate that light.
Mm-hmm. Oh, which reminds me, next week we're going to be discussing Testimony of Light, which talks about that in depth.
That is an amazing book, and
yeah.
I can't wait to talk
about that
book. I love it. I love that book. You know, I have to say, I don't think we'll ever do a book on the show we don't like.
No, I should hope not. Although, I have to be honest with you, Deb, you want me to do the Eckhart Tolle book. I had a really hard time reading that book.
Me too, but
you
I
did?
Love it.
The Power of Now.
Anyway, but you know, you and I talk about light all the time. If you are a regular listener to our Psychic Teachers podcast, you know we always end that show with the sentence, be the light.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we become our own teachers, and then how do we become the light for ourselves and for other people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a balancing act. And I think first you have to shine that light on yourself. Because
yes.
One of the things that you and I keep seeing, especially in our spiritual coaching work, is that so many people who are drawn to spirituality, so I'm not talking about the average person, you know, going to work and sitting in their cubicle and coming home and watching TV. I'm talking about spiritual seekers who are drawn to shows like ours, are so generous and kind and giving and loving. And the way that they achieve happiness is by giving to others. And I think that's so beautiful and commendable. However, what we see is that they tend to leave themselves out of that formula, and then they wonder, why do I feel a void? What's missing? Why do I still feel lost? And it's because they haven't taken time to shine their beautiful light on themselves.
Right.
So think about if we are a prism, if we are a crystal prism, if you shine your light out from that crystal prism, it's going to be one beam, which is great, good. But if you shine that light through you, it's going to come out of that prison in a million beams.
Yes.
So the more you can focus on being the light for yourself, the more energy and awareness you'll have to be the light for other people.
Exactly. We have a great comment in the chat room. I admit this book made me look at how I live my life and my habits, especially when he fasted from unhealthy foods.
Oh, yeah,
I was totally eating a bowl of ice cream while reading that part. And I'm not laughing at you. I am laughing with you because I do the same thing. Yes.
That was really hard to read all of the physical abstaining he had to go through.
Right.
Yeah, that's hard. And again, though, I have to say, that goes back to balance.
It does. It does. Several years ago, I did a 3-day fast
mm-hmm.
with a friend who just came over, and we spent our days and evenings together. It was during one of my breaks, so I had time to be at home and be alone. And then she would leave and go home for the night and come back the next morning. And we just did a juice fast for 3 days. And it was amazing to me what emotions came up during that time,
mm-hmm.
what our conversations were, how I viewed my body and that mind-body-spirit connection.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 days was about all I could do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very commendable. But, yeah, I think so many of us hide behind food.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is important to do that. I just mean balance in terms of, you know, how I have a hard time with people who cut whole food groups out of their diet. And I don't mean when you have an allergy to it. I mean just because it's like the trendy thing to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it comes back to balance.
I agree.
I wanted to read, if I could, two more questions and answers.
You can. Let me just answer a question in the chat room, if you don't mind. There's a question about, is the movie similar to the book and have we seen it? I don't know. I have seen it. You have?
I have. I own it. It's similar. Yeah, they do a good job of getting it in those 2 hours, but it's just not the same.
There's not the depth of
the detail
that's in the book.
I would recommend you read the book and then watch the movie.
There you go.
So someone has written to Dan Millman and asked him, is Socrates real or fictional? And he says, I did indeed meet a real person, a cosmic old service station mechanic at around 3 a.m. on a starry night in December of 1966. Because he reminded me of the ancient Greek sage, I called him Socrates. My more recent novel, The Journeys of Socrates, relates the challenging saga of his life.
Which is also a beautiful book, by the way.
From the beginning, I've stated quite clearly that The Way of the Peaceful Warrior is an autobiographical novel blending fact and fiction. But let's say it was all true, that everything described happened exactly as I described it, or let's say it was not. What does this have to do with your daily life? Whether or not Socrates could jump on rooftops or send me on mystical journeys at the touch of his hand, how does this impact your relationships? Are you seeking evidence of miracles or ways to be stronger, kinder, or wiser?
Right.
Yeah. And then someone asked him, why does Socrates speak to you so harshly at times? And I thought that was a really good question, because Socrates is really hard on him sometimes.
He sure is. Yeah.
He says, Socrates poked fun at me to show me how easily I became offended. He treated most people with respect. In any case, he had his style, and I have mine. Sometimes it may be necessary to shake a student out of denial or lethargy, but I teach with respect and understanding. So I want to speak to that more specifically in a minute, but first I just want to tell people who we are.
Perfect. God, I'm writing
us in
the chat.
And you are Deb Bowen, and we are the Psychic Teachers. You can find out about us by going to psychicteachers.com or debbowen.com or samanthafay.com. We are still not on iTunes, Deb, so hopefully we'll be on there this week so that you can download our podcast. For now, you can listen to archived podcast of our book club on blogtalkradio.com.
Okay, wait. That was a lot of comms.
Okay.
let's do this. Our Psychic Teachers webpage is not updated at the moment, so let's do this. debbowen.com, samanthafay.com, and certainly blogtalkradio.com, Psychic Teachers. So those are the best ways to connect with us. We are psychics. We do readings for people around the world. We are coaches, spiritual coaches, and we both offer courses that you can download. Those are available on my website, and Samantha has a lot of cool products for sale on her website as well. So please check us out. We would really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay,
so I liked how he says that Socrates poked fun at him to show how easily he became offended. This was something that I really dealt with a lot in my 20s and 30s. I used to become offended if someone didn't share the same opinion as I did.
Oh.
You know, there's a distant family member in my family who's very old school in terms of his political views. And I used to have such debates with him in my 20s, and I would get so offended that his views to me were so harmful. You know, like he was against all illegals in the country. That was just hurtful to me, you know. He was against homosexuality, which was hurtful to me. And I can remember just debating with him and crying. I was so sensitive. Gosh, all those writing classes I took in my 20s, if someone didn't like every word I wrote, I was like, well, forget you. And I think part of growing in spirituality is not necessarily growing in confidence, because I wouldn't say I'm any more confident now than I was in my 20s and 30s. But what I would say is that I'm much more comfortable with who I am, my flaws and my positives.
Well, you know, here's what Socrates had to say to that. Act happy. Be happy without a reason in the world. Then you can love and do what you will. Feelings change, sometimes sorrow, sometimes joy. But beneath it all, remember the innate perfection of your life unfolding. That is the secret of unreasonable happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Is to not buy into or care about what somebody else thinks about you.
That's right. Well, that's one of the four agreements. It's none
that's
of your
right.
business.
That's right. What other people think of you is not your business.
Yeah, and I really do think that you can achieve that state to some degree. I still, you know, look, if someone points fingers at me and laughs and says, you look so ugly, like, I'm going to get my feelings hurt, you know. But not for long. You know, like my bounce back period is a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important when you're on that spiritual journey to try to have that, like I was saying before, that light come from within you, not around you.
Yes, and so to have that light, to have that awareness, to reach a point of happiness, to be your own Socrates,
mm-hmm.
all of that comes from a place of balance and centeredness,
mm-hmm.
that balance of mind, body, spirit, as we were saying, and a place of joy and trust, and a place of stillness.
Yes.
I'm back to Meditation 101.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited last week to speak to a group of elementary school teachers about meditation. And I was so delighted to do that. And, of course, when we started the class, they wanted me to focus on how to calm their children down in their classrooms. And I said, well, first you got to calm you. And they all wiggled, and many of them were uncomfortable with that. But by the time we had finished the hour, they were more willing to realize that what they emanated impacted their students, and that they first needed to take care of themselves.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
There's I don't know if you read this quote in the book. He says, life has three rules: paradox, humor, and change.
Yes, yes, it's one
paradox, life is a mystery, don't waste your time trying to figure it out. Humor, keep a sense of humor, especially about yourself, it's a strength beyond measure. Change, know that nothing ever stays the same.
Right.
The first one, I think, is so crucial. Paradox, life is a mystery, don't waste your time trying to figure it out. You know, my dad's name is Thomas, and we always joke and call him Doubting Thomas because he was trained by the Jesuits, and, you know, he fluctuates in his faith constantly. And he'll always call me up and say, Samantha, did you hear about that little boy that was chained up outside of his house and beaten by his father every day and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, Dad, I read about that. Well, how can God allow that to happen? and then he's off on his whole tangent of, well, I don't believe anymore. And I have to tell him, like, we can't know. I mean, we're simpletons in terms of the higher power's intelligence. Do you know what I mean? We're
mm-hmm.
like two-year-olds. And we can't comprehend or grasp the mysteries of the universe. I don't think any of us can grasp the mysteries of goodness or evil. And so if you just accept that life is a mystery, hopefully you won't waste time overanalyzing everything, the way my very intelligent but, you know, doubting father does.
You know, sometimes you just have to say, it is what it is, and I'm doing the best I can do.
Yeah, yeah. I say that a lot as a mother. I really do.
If I ever
get down on myself with, you know, if I yell at the kids or if I feel a weekend passed and I didn't spend every single minute with them, I will sit down and I will say, Samantha, you are doing the best you can do.
Yeah, and you have to realize that your children are growing up and there's going to come a time when they don't want to spend every minute with you in the weekend.
There is a scary thing, if I can digress, on Pinterest. There's a thing going around and it says between the day of your child's birth and the day they leave for college, there are 940 Saturdays.
Oh, wow.
Not a lot.
That's not a lot.
Anyway, but I think it is important to accept that life is a mystery, to keep a sense of humor about yourself, and to know that nothing is ever going to stay the same, to accept change. Gosh, those three things, especially the first and the last, the paradox and change, I think are the hardest for people.
Right. In the pagan tradition, there's a sentence that says, she changes everything she touches, and everything she touches changes. To pass, to think about the eternalness and the cyclicalness of change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you can come to a point where you find comfort in change. You know, like I've said on our other show, I have a sign in my kitchen that reads, "This too shall pass."
My mama used to say that all the time, and I have to tell you, when I was a teenager, I hated her saying that, because whatever my angst was the biggest thing in the universe, and it was going to last forever.
Gosh darn it.
Gosh darn it. And then, you know, she's always right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like to look at that sign, and I remind my girls to look at that sign, because not only will the bad times pass, but the good times will pass too. So you have to appreciate all of it. And like you said, everything is going to change, but everything is cyclical.
Right.
So the good times will pass, and the good times will come back around again.
That's right. That is absolutely true. I mean, you know, in my backyard is just beginning to blossom. The buds are on the dogwood trees. I've got daffodils and hyacinths blooming, and the leaves are budding out on the red bud trees. And, you know, all that spring stuff is happening in the
mm-hmm.
micro ecosystem that is my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And after this long, cold, wet winter, to see that resurgence and rebirth, how can you not have hope in cycles and change
right.
at this time of year?
Right. You have to have hope. And I think keeping humor about yourself, just, again, being aware of that and just laughing. My sister told the funniest story yesterday. So she's been married for 26 years, and when she got married, the day she could care less about, like, wedding dresses, and, you know, she's not into all that stuff. So we're all at her house helping her get ready. The hairstylist is there, and she's all ready, and one of the bridesmaids says, "Where are your shoes?" And she goes, "My what?" She never bought wedding shoes. And my sister is almost 6 feet tall and wears a size 10, so it's not like any of us had white heels we could lend her. So her best friend's daughter, who had just turned 16, goes, "I'm on it." And she runs to Kmart, which is the nearest store to my sister's house, grabs a pair of pleather size 10 white heels, screams to the lines on this Saturday morning, "My friend's getting married in 10 minutes and she needs these shoes." Gets them, drives it home. Courtney marches down the aisle in her Kmart shoes. So yesterday, she's been training for 9 months for this marathon, right? She's got to be there at 5:30 in the morning to be ready for the start time at 6 a.m. She picks up her friend that they've been training every day together. They get to the start line. She gets out of the car. She's still in her slippers.
Oh, no. What did she do?
She had to call her husband over and over and over again to wake him up, and then he met her halfway, and they switched out the shoes. And she got to the starting line at exactly 6 o'clock and finished beautifully.
I'll be darned.
But the key thing is, on both of those hugely stressful occasions, my sister just laughed and laughed and laughed.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you got to do. You can't take that, those events, and go, "Oh, I'm such a dummy. How could I do that? What was I thinking?" You know, life is too short.
Yeah.
There's enough people that are willing to beat you up. You don't have to do it yourself.
Absolutely. And I just have to say that as an old beach girl, there's also a lesson in learning to go barefooted and touch the earth. But
I'll just
leave that alone. Oh, dear. So we have 90 seconds. I just want to read this.
Okay.
This is from Socrates. When you sit, sit. When you stand, stand. Whatever you do, don't wobble. Once you make your choice, do it with all your spirit.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, finish with your Yoda quote.
Do or do not do, there
yeah.
is no try.
Yeah.
Do or do not, there is no try.
I love that quote.
I do too.
All right, so next week, everybody, please join us again, where we will be discussing Testimony of Light.
By Helen Greaves, Greaves. We thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to having you with us next week.
Be the light.
Bye-bye, everybody.